Chapter 34B. Heavy Weather. Bonus chapter exclusive to the US edition. Bookworld Meteorology. Aside from the rain, snow, and wind that often feature within the pages of novels for dramatic effect, another weather system works within the bookworld, a sort of transgenre wind that is not a moving mass of air, but one of text, sense distortion, and snippets of ideas. It is usually only a mild zephyr whose welcome breeze brings with it a useful cross-fertilization of ideas within the genres, and usually has no greater vice than the spread of the misspelling virus. On occasion, however, the wind has been known to whip itself up into a word storm that can dislodge whole sentences and plot devices and deposit them several genres away. It's not a common phenomenon, but it's wise to keep an eye on it. In my second week as bellman, a word storm of unprecedented ferocity hit the library. It was the first real test of my bellmanship. I think I did okay. Thursday next. Private Diaries. I was asleep in my room in the Sunderland not long after my inauguration as bellman. Everything had been pretty quiet that week. A few page runners and a sighting of the Minotaur, but nothing too serious. Text Grand Central was still coming to grips with the new management regime, and all the story code engines had been shut down and rebooted to rid them of the UltraWord operating system. So a lull was not only welcome, but necessary. I was awoken from my slumber by a loud purring, and was shocked to find the cat, formerly known as Cheshire, about an inch from my nose.
"Hello," he purred, grinning fit to burst. "Were you dreaming about oysters?"
"No," I confessed. "In fact," I added, rubbing my eyes and attempting to sit up, "I don't think I've ever dreamt about oysters."
"Really? I dream about them all the time. Sometimes on the half shell, and other times in an oyster bed. Sometimes I dream about them playing the piano."
"How can an oyster play the piano?"
"No, I dream about them when I'm playing the piano."
I looked at the clock. It was 3 in the morning. "Did you wake me up to tell me about your oyster dreams?"
"Not at all. I can't think for a moment why you are interested. Something has come up over at Text Grand Central, and we thought you should be informed."
I was suddenly a great deal wider awake. I moved to get up, and the cat politely faded from view as I stepped from the bed. "So what's up?" I asked, slipping on a T-shirt.
"It's the text wind," said the cat from the corridor. "We've been monitoring it all day, and there is a possibility it could whip itself up into a word storm."
Weather inside fiction is much like weather at home, only usually more extreme. Book rain generally comes down in stair-rods, and book snow always has flakes the size of farthings. But these all exist within books for narrative purposes. The book world itself has less easily recognised weather patterns, but has them just the same. A particularly bad storm in 34 swept through horror and rained detritus on drama for weeks. The most notable result being the grisly spontaneous combustion sequence in Dickens's Bleak House. I pulled on my trousers and shoes and walked out of the door, leaving Pickwick and her chick asleep in an untidy snoring mass on the rug. The cat was waiting for me, and together we jumped to Text Grand Central. TGC was the technical nerve centre of the bookworld, modified from an unpublished gothic horror novel. The 100 floors of TGC were lit by flickering gas mantles that only faintly illuminated the vaulted ceilings high above the polished marble floors. We entered near the corner of floor 69, and I followed the cat as we walked past the humming story code engines, each one a colossi of cast iron, shiny brass, and polished mahogany. Just one of 500 on this floor alone, the bus-sized machine could cope with up to 50,000 simultaneous readings of the same book, or one reading apiece of 50,000 different books as demand saw fit. I had only visited TGC once before as part of my induction to the bellman's job, and was amazed not only on how impossible the concept was to my flat outlander mind, but the supreme scale of it all. The technicians scurried like tireless ants over the clanking machinery, checking dials, oiling moving parts, and venting steam while keeping a close lookout for any narrative anomalies to report to the collators upstairs. It was from these collators that reports of fiction infractions, page runners, and all the other bookworld misdemeanors filtered through to us at the jurisfiction offices. The whole system was hopelessly antiquated and manpower-intensive, but it worked. We left the engine floor and walked into a large anteroom where the bookworld meteorological department worked. It was here the 10-strong team spent their days busily searching for patterns in the seemingly random textual anomalies that occur throughout fiction. The department was run by Dr. Howard. I had met him briefly once before and knew that a century or two ago he had been real, like me. TGC had commissioned a biography of the original Luke Howard solely so a generic could be trained and then employed part-time in this office. "Ah," he said as we walked in. "Glad you're here, Bellman. Heavy weather moving in from the Western genre. This is Senator Jobsworth from the Council of Genres, here as part of the CFG Committee for Observation of Anomalies." Jobsworth, a small and weedy-looking man, didn't look comfortable nor regal in his senatorial robes. As part of the regime change after the UltraWord debacle, it was deemed that a senator should be present at any unusual event. He looked shifty, and I took an instant dislike to him. "Senator," I said, bowing slightly as protocol dictated. "Miss Next," he said dryly, "I must tell you right now that I didn't vote for you. I will be keeping a close eye on your behaviour." "Good," I replied non-committally, then added, "What's up, Dr. Howard?" He motioned us towards the centre of the room where beneath us, in a recessed pit, there was a large map of the book world. "We plot everything," he explained as the staff below moved marker tags with long sticks to the orders of the controllers above. "From the largest unconstrained narrative flexation to the smallest tense distortion. Then, by plotting the size of the changes and their positions, a rough map of the bookworld's weather can be constructed." I looked down at the sea of small markers, which seemed, indeed, to have a sort of swirling pattern to them. He pointed to a mass of reports. "About 2 hours ago, an outbreak of anomalous plot flexations began in Riders of the Purple Sage." "The Minotaur was reported in Zane Grey last week," I commented.
"That's what we thought at first," replied Dr. Howard, "but the slight flexations were moving too fast to be a page runner.
Within 20 minutes, a cloud of grammatical oddities had joined the weather front, and together they left the Western genre. The front brushed the southeast corner of erotica and vanished 10 minutes later into stream of consciousness."
"Vanished?"
"Difficult to spot, perhaps. It's been quiet in SOC ever since. But that's not all. At pretty much the same time, a cloud of mispunctuation arose in horror, circled twice, and then developed into a pretty stiff breeze of split infinitives and jumbled words before travelling through fantasy into romance. Unchallenged, it hit the Farquhar series and split in two. One storm front headed north into Steele, the other along the Collins Ridge just east of Krantz. We expect the two fronts to merge just past Cooper in a few minutes."
"So we can safely say it's over, then?" asked the Senator, staring at the plotting table with more than a little confusion.
"Up to a point, Senator," replied Dr. Howard diplomatically. "As you so expertly point out, it just might dissipate into the Taylor Bradford canon harmlessly."
"Oh, good," said the Senator, with relief.
"However," continued Dr. Howard, "and far be it from me to contradict your grace, it's equally probable they will strengthen and then careen off on a destructive course towards drama."
"Boss," said a technician who had been staring at a list of recent anomalies, "I think you better see this."
Below us on the plotting table, we could see a small bulge emerge on the western flanks of Stream of Consciousness.
"How fast?" asked Dr. Howard.
"About 3 pages a second.
"Give me a projected route."
The technician picked up a slide rule and scribbled some notes on a pad of paper. Unluckily for us, the front that had begun in Western had traversed Stream of Consciousness and emerged 4 times as strong.
"I knew we hadn't seen the last of it," muttered Howard. "Damn and blast!"
But that wasn't all. In the next 2 minutes, we watched nervously as the split storm fronts coursing through romance rejoined, grew stronger, and diverted off towards drama as feared.
"And that's why we called you,"
said Dr. Howard, gazing at me intently. In under 10 minutes, the romance and stream of consciousness frontal systems will merge and strengthen. We've got a wordstorm brewing of magnitude 5.4 or more, heading straight for drama.
5.4? Echoed the senator. That's good, right?
In storm terms, it's very good, replied Dr. Howard grimly. Make no mistake about that. A 2.3 might only scramble text and change tenses. A 3.5 can muddle chapters and remove entire words. Anything above a 5 has enough power to tear whole ideas and paragraphs out of a book and dump them several shelves away.
Okay,
I said slowly, as Commander Bradshaw appeared, looking a bit bleary-eyed.
Glad you could make it, Trafford. We've got a potential wordstorm brewing.
Wordstorm, eh? He mused. Reminds me of a typhoon that struck the French lieutenant's woman 10 years back. By God, we were picking superfluous adjectives out of the book for a month.
And that had been a small one, added Dr. Howard. Barely a 2.1.
Cat, I said, issue a storm warning to the residents of all books on the storm's path. Trafford, we need every single Danver clone we have on 30-second readiness. I want textual sieves ready and standing by.
Well, said Senator Jobsworth, this is all quite exciting, isn't it? And what is a textual sieve anyway?
We all ignored him and moved to a table in Dr. Howard's office, where one of his team had unrolled a more detailed map of the threatened area of drama. It was essentially one of Bradshaw's booksploring charts, overlaid with the footnotophone conduits in red ink. The map looked like a giant spiderweb of interconnections, the books that remained unexplored standing alone and unprotected. If we couldn't get in to warn them, they certainly wouldn't be able to see it coming. We waited patiently as the minutes ticked by, the plotters updating the course of the two storm fronts on the chart as they merged, gathered speed, and hurtled across the emptiness of intergenre space directly towards drama. Bradshaw had relayed my orders to the Danver clones. All we needed was the title of the books most likely to be hit by the coming storm.
Why don't we set up those textual sieves across this area here? Suggested Senator Jobsworth, waving a hand at the chart.
We mustn't spread our sieves too thin, I explained. We need them concentrated at the place the storm hits to do any good at all. As if to confirm its waywardness, the storm changed direction. It had been heading almost straight for the satire end of drama when it veered away and headed instead for novel.
Which one do you think, old girl?
Asked Bradshaw, footnotophone in hand. It was one of those moments where leadership has a lonely, hollow emptiness to it. The wrong decision now, and we could be mopping up the mess for years. Give my order too early, and the storm might veer again and cut an ugly swath through Trollope. Give the order too late, and the textual sieves might not be up in time to stop the storm in its tracks. A half-unfurled sieve would be broken like matchwood and carried with the storm to who knows where.
What shall we do, Bellman?
Asked the cat. He wasn't smiling. A technician updated the plot. The storm had moved slightly to the west and was now 4 minutes from hitting drama. Would it hold that course or veer off again?
Dr. Howard, I said, I need your best estimate.
It's almost impossible to say.
I know that, I snapped. Like it or not, you are the best guesser, and I'm going to go with your hunch. That's my decision. Now, where do you think it will hit?
He sighed resignedly and stabbed a finger on the map.
I think about here. Page 214 of the Scarlet Letter. Give or take a chapter or two.
Hawthorne, I murmured. Not good. No one had ever travelled into any of his books before, so the Danver clones would be working on the books closest to it. Never a satisfactory alternative.
Right, I said, drawing a deep breath. Do we have an updated report on the size of this wordstorm?
It's now a 5.7, replied the technician in a voice tinged with fear.
And it's heavy with ideas and plot devices picked up on its journey so far.
Compact?
I'd say,
replied the technician, reading the latest weather report. Barely 3 paragraphs wide, but with a density over 6.4. It's currently moving at 8 pages a second.
It could tear a hole straight through the Scarlet Letter at that rate, exploded Bradshaw, and litter the whole book with dramatic events.
The consequence of this was terrible to consider. A new version of the Scarlet Letter where things actually happen? Impact time.
3 minutes.
I had an idea. How many people are reading Scarlet Letter at present?
622,
replied the cat, who as librarian had these figures at his paws 24 hours a day. Pleasure readers?
Mostly, replied the cat, thinking hard, except for a class of 32 English students at Frobisher High School in Michigan who are studying it.
Good. Bradshaw, I want you to set up textual sieves in every book ever written by Hemingway, even the bad ones. Sieves are to be set to course in all short stories, letters, winner-take-nothing, and In Our Time, medium in The Sun Also Rises and The Green Hills of Africa. I want to channel the storm, slowing it down as it passes. By A Farewell to Arms and For Whom the Bell Tolls, sieves should be set to fine. The storm will bounce between all the works, moving west towards the void between Hemingway and Fitzgerald. If it makes it that far, we'll reset the sieves and attack again. There was a pause.
But Thursday, said Bradshaw slowly. The storm isn't going to hit Hemingway.
It will if we shut the Scarlet Letter down.
Out of the question, exploded Senator Jobsworth, spontaneously and automatically rejecting any possible infringements of his sacred regulations. The rules do not permit any book to be shut down without a vote at the Council of Genres.
I can quote the rule number if you wish. Technically, he was right. Even with a vote, nobody had tried anything so audacious before. It usually took an hour to shut down a book, more to bring it up to full readability again.
Is that wise? Asked Dr. Howard.
Not in the least, I replied. But I'm out of time and ideas right now.
Isn't anyone listening to me?
Continued the senator, more outraged at our lack of respect than at losing the Scarlet Letter.
Oh, we're listening, all right, purred the cat. We just don't agree with you.
Rules are there for a good reason, Miss Next. We have ordered the demolition of bigger books than the Scarlet Letter.
I personally...
Listen, I said. Classics have been lost before, but never during my tenure as bellman. Tomorrow morning you can have my badge if I'm wrong and send me packing. Right now, you can sit down and shut up. Cat and Bradshaw, are you with me on this?
Appreciate a woman who can make bold decisions,
muttered Bradshaw, repeating my orders to the Danver clones. Senator Jobsworth had gone red with impotent fury, and his mouth was twitching as he sought to find words to adequately express his anger at my insubordination.
2 minutes to impact.
I picked up the footnotophone and asked to be put through to the story code engine floor. Bradshaw, I want you to take a trip to the Outland and set the fire alarm off at Frobisher High in exactly 78 seconds. That will give us a few minutes breathing space. The pleasure readers will just think they've got bored and lost concentration when the book shuts down. Hello, story code floor. This is the bellman. I want you to divert Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter to an empty story code engine and shut it down. Yes, that's quite correct. Shut it down. I don't have time to issue a written order, so you're going to have to take my word for it. You are to do it in exactly 63 seconds.
Sieves are going up as requested, Thursday, reported Bradshaw. Think they'll hold?
I shrugged. There was nothing else we could do. The storm plot ran toward the Scarlet Letter and struck it just as the story code engine shut down. The book closed. The characters stopped in their tracks as an all-pervading darkness swept over every descriptive passage, every line of dialogue, every nuance, every concept. Where a moment ago there had been a fascinating treatise on morality, there was now only a lifeless hulk of dark reading matter. It was as if the Scarlet Letter had never been written. The storm bounced off, then attracted to the brighter lights of the Hemingway cannon next door, struck off on a new course. I breathed a sigh of relief but then held my breath once more as the storm struck In Our Time and glanced off. The sieve had held. Only the next few minutes the word storm ran between the books as planned, the textual sieve slowing it down as it brushed past the collected works of Hemingway.
Damage report?
Slight grammatical warpage in A Farewell to Arms, but nothing serious, said the cat. The Sun Also Rises is reporting isolated bursts of narrative flexations, but nothing we can't handle. All other books report no damage.
Good. Bring the Scarlet Letter back online. We watched nervously as the storm slowly subsided. It had littered the Hemingway canon with words and ideas, but nothing violent enough to embed them and change the narrative. As likely as not, the residents of the novels would just pick them up and sell them to travelling scrap merchants. But the word storm wasn't quite finished with us yet. After brushing past the preface to For Whom the Bell Tolls, the storm suddenly sped up, and in its last dying throes, embedded a bride shot at the altar plot device right at the end of Blackmore's Lorna Doone, where it remains to this day. Aside from that minor flexation, no real harm was done by the word storm. The senator berated me for a good 10 minutes and filed a report on my behaviour the following day, which was summarily rejected by the other members of the Jurisfiction Oversight Committee. I left the Cat and Bradshaw to log the damage reports and thanked Dr. Howard and his staff for their slavish attention. I decided to walk back home, across the StoryCode engine floor and down the empty corridors of the Great Library to the Well of Lost Plots and back to bed. I was feeling quite good about myself. I had run a team of highly skilled technicians and saved the Scarlet Letter from almost certain devastation. It would be one of my easier tasks as bellman, but I didn't know that yet. The evening had gone well. Landon would have been proud of me.